Thousands of years ago, as King Solomon dedicated the temple in Jerusalem, he emphasized that the sanctity of the site was not for Israelites alone. There will, he predicted, be Gentiles that will be drawn to Jerusalem as a place of prayer. And he phrased his own words to God as follows. Moreover, concerning a Gentile that is not of thy people Israel, but cometh out of a far country for thy name's sake, for they shall hear of thy great name and of thy strong hand and of thy stretched out arm. When he shall come and pray toward this house, hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and do according to all that the Gentile calleth to thee. So Solomon said, and as I wrote in my most recent column and commentary, it is not clear that Solomon, as wise as he was, could have predicted in that moment from how far away Gentiles would one day come to Jerusalem, and the unusual ways in which this prediction would be fulfilled. Thus it was just a couple days ago when the Argentinian president, Javier Milei, alighted from his plane in Tel Aviv. He immediately announced that he'd be moving Argentina's embassy to Jerusalem, and then he proceeded to the Western Wall as a crowd gathered around this visiting head of state. As Milei touched the millennia-old stones, he suddenly broke down and wept. The Western Wall had become the Wailing Wall once more, only now it was not a Jew weeping on those stones. It was a non-Jew who had come, in Solomon's phrase, from a faraway land, from a whole other hemisphere. The reason why that moment on video was so moving to me, and why I wrote my column and commentary about it, was precisely because, as you all understand, it came at a moment when the Jewish people are feeling a resurgence of anti-Semitism making itself manifest. Suddenly here before my eyes, there was a prominent non-Jew who not only opposed Jew hate, but who was suddenly and seemingly moved, overcome by touching, experiencing, feeling the age-old experiences of the Jewish people. In a time of darkness, the light stood out all the more. And this in turn led me to realize that this was not the first time that a non-Jew was so moved by an encounter with the Western Wall and all that it embodied about Jewish history. Indeed, I myself knew of another such encounter, and it is told in a short, beautiful book by the Catholic scholar Maria Johnson, who teaches at the University of Scranton. She describes, in her wonderful work, Strangers and Neighbors, her friendship with Orthodox Jews and what she has learned from it. The book is written by Johnson from a Christian perspective, obviously from a different perspective than my own. And I can say that it is, I think, the best book by a non-Jew that I have ever read about Judaism. Johnson tells us that our first important encounter with Jewish life occurred in Jerusalem Friday evening in the Old City. She had been traveling in Israel when she suddenly had the urge to hop in a taxi and go to the Western Wall as the sun set, Erev Shabbat. There, massed at the wall, she saw, she writes, quote, faithful Jews battered by the horrors of the past and the bitterness of the present, go there to mourn the destruction of the temple and the passing of the days when the Ark of the Covenant was in the Holy of Holies and the name of the God of Israel was revered everywhere. The wall, she continues, is ancient. It has absorbed history, soaking it in through its pores, and it exudes the ancient, sacred, lost past into the air of the modern square with its metal detectors and lounging teenage soldiers. I am, she continued, usually one to be impressed by old things, but this evening, the present was intensely more interesting than the past. The mood among the Jews who crowded the plaza to welcome the Sabbath was one not of lamentation, nostalgia, loss, or bitterness, but of joy, deep and serious and exultant joy. Mature men with full beards and long black coats, men exuding gravitas as the wall exuded antiquity, were dancing and singing with abandon. It was, she concludes, alien and intense and thrilling, and it was important. So Johnson writes, now what so impressed her about this experience? As she seemed to say, it was not just the antiquity of the wall, but actually the present that impressed itself upon her. In other words, it was the joining of the Jewish past, ancient as it was, with the living Jew. She seemed suddenly to sense that Jerusalem, that Judaism, was not only about the past, but rather a living reality. It is, as Solomon said, a source of inspiration to the world. It is a miracle. Johnson herself sensed the suffusing spirit of the environs. She seemed overcome, or as she put it, "I'm a scholar, trained to keep a rein on my personal responses and to regard everything from a safe analytical distance. But there was no question of my coolly observing the scene as an interesting cultural religious phenomenon. I found myself quite certain that something really was happening as the sun slipped behind the rooftops of Jerusalem, that the whirling, singing crowds were responding to a reality greater than any culture. It mattered deeply that there they were, that they were there, spinning and rejoicing and praying and welcoming Shabbos Malka, the Queen of Sabbath." This is how Johnson describes her experience at the Western Wall. She was, like Millet just was, overcome with emotion. But for Johnson, this in turn turned her mind away from Jerusalem to a very different Jewish environs, her block in Scranton, Pennsylvania. For Johnson lives, not, I think we could say, in the Orthodox neighborhood of Scranton, PA, because I don't think there really is a Orthodox neighborhood, but she lives on an Orthodox block. As she tells us, quote, "A year before the Israel trip, my husband and I had moved into a beautiful but dilapidated Victorian house, 5 blocks from campus. Buying it had been a piece of romantic folly. It had gorgeous pocket doors, a lovely tiled fireplace, stained glass windows, and even a turret. But it also had a crumbling staircase, splintered siding, caved-in ceilings, and lethally archaic wiring, which was why we could afford it. The neighborhood was a bit iffy, but the house was 2 blocks from one Orthodox synagogue, 4 blocks from another, and 3 from the Hebrew day school that served a healthy and growing Orthodox community. We told ourselves that it surely had to be a safe place to live, signed the contract, and got to work. So when I came home to Glenn and the baby, it was to a neighborhood with a very visible Jewish life. I wanted," she writes, "to walk up to people on the street and say, 'Hello, I just got back from Jerusalem,' in the hope that they would talk to me about it and make me feel connected to a place I missed after being there only 5 days. But I was restrained by my reluctance to make a complete idiot of myself in front of strangers." So in other words, Johnson had, as she describes it, in an act of complete folly, bought a home right next to Orthodox Jews. And what may have seemed folly was actually, I believe, providence. And now she was inspired by her experience of the Jews at the wall to speak and address and befriend the Jews of Scranton. Johnson tells us how quickly she became good friends with 2 Orthodox families on her block. And now, she tells us, "The women and I lend each other maternity clothes and go to the gym together. Our husbands borrow each other's snow shovels and power tools and grumble about local politics. Our children are in and out of each other's houses." But the friendship, as Johnson goes on to describe, actually results in something more, in the exposure of Maria Johnson and her family to the richness of Orthodox Jewish life, to a degree that many Jews today even have not had the chance to experience. Her family has, at this point, sat at Shabbat tables, attended Megillah readings, and she even knows what a Shalom Zachar is and why that takes place. Even as they remain devout Roman Catholics, the Johnsons now take it for granted that every year they'll spend some time in a sukkah, watch the lighting of Hanukkah candles, and receive mishloach manot on Purim, where, as she puts it, for Christians such as herself and her family, quote, "the Jewish calendar and its celebrations," she says, she writes how the Jewish holidays, quote, "have become part of our year just as Shabbos has become part of our week, a counterpoint playing softly under the melody of the church's calendar, creating unexpected and poignant harmonies." So Johnson writes. She further tells us that her children have had a complete education from their Orthodox friends about what Judaism is. And in fact, her children consider themselves experts on Judaism. She tells us, "Once on vacation, we found ourselves in a museum elevator with an Orthodox family. Fearing what might happen, I jabbered merrily about the dinosaurs, but to no avail. Catherine and Elizabeth," that's her children, "Catherine and Elizabeth chirped in unison, 'Oh, hello, "You're Jews." The doors opened before I had time to stammer out an explanation. "Then," she continues, "there was a time at the park when Catherine was playing with a little boy while I chatted to his very pleasant father. When the boy," and then she describes how the boy happened to say that he's Jewish, but this was not a member of the Orthodox Jewish community. So she writes, "Catherine looked him up and down, no yarmulke, no tzitzis, and said coolly, 'You must be one of those Jews who don't know their mitzvahs.'" So Maria Johnson writes about her Catholic child approaching, random Jews in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So it's about friendship. That leads to the most obvious question. Why does she title the book Strangers and Neighbors? In what way are her close friends strangers? The subtitle of the book makes sense. It is what I have learned about Christianity from living among Orthodox Jews. But why strangers and neighbors? And indeed, the original article in the magazine First Things about her friendship was called Us and Them, which also highlights separation, not closeness. So the explanation lies in Johnson's recognition that deep religious differences divide them, and that you can't just dissolve these differences or do away with them. Johnson tells us that it is, quote, a difficult business to live in close proximity with people who are different. Always has been, always will be. But she adds, we have to learn to do it, or we may not make it into the next century. However, she further cautions, we can't afford simply to jettison whatever convictions and commitments might clash with the convictions of others, because when the going gets tough, and it will, we're going to need our convictions and commitments. So in other words, that's Johnson. So in other words, we have to learn to appreciate each other. We can learn from each other, but that doesn't mean that you can pretend like these differences don't matter. In her First Things article originally, Johnson added the following. There is a great deal of nonsense written on the subject of diversity and multiculturalism, but the fact remains that the great challenge facing our world is that of maintaining clear convictions and strong commitments while living in peaceful proximity with people with different convictions and commitments, avoiding brittle bigotry on the one hand and soggy relativism on the other. That's a perfectly stated phrase, avoiding brittle bigotry on the one hand and soggy relativism on the other. In other words, the more friendly she becomes with these Orthodox Jews, the more she understands that they also disagree on some basic questions of religious truth. They are, in other words, both strangers and neighbors. And what's so interesting about this is twofold. First, what you see from the book is the fact that they are both strangers and neighbors helps make them actually better and closer neighbors, better and closer friends. Religious certainty is not an obstacle in her friendship with her Orthodox Jewish friends. On the contrary, she writes, quote, we feel comfortable around the very different world our neighbors inhabit because nobody pretends the worlds aren't different. The boundaries between us and our Orthodox neighbors are unequivocally clear, and nobody tries to hide them or gloss over them. Nobody acts as if they are silly or embarrassing or if they are superficial or don't really matter. They do matter, and everyone knows it. Or, to put it slightly differently, what Johnson is telling us is that recognizing what sets them apart actually allows them to be better friends. And what's so striking, and this brings us to our second point about the title, is that the very title itself, Strangers and Neighbors, unbeknownst, I think, to Maria Johnson, is the phrase that served as a theme of one of the most important reflections on the Jewish interfaith encounter in the 20th century. It was my great uncle, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, in his essay on interfaith relations, Confrontation, who argued that to be a Jew in the world is to embody Abraham's introduction of himself to his fellow denizens. Abraham said, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, I am a stranger and a neighbor among you. Meaning, said Rabbi Soloveitchik, Abraham was saying, I am set apart by my faith, set apart, but still want to dedicate myself to working with you. That's what Rabbi Soloveitchik said. And what Rabbi Soloveitchik is communicating, to paraphrase Maria Johnson, is that in our interactions with others, we need to avoid brittle bigotry and soggy relativism. And he further emphasizes this point, because I think Rabbi Soloveitchik was worried about the profound potential for both brittle bigotry and soggy relativism in the years to come. Thus, the fact remains that throughout the years, when I speak to audiences, both Jewish and Christian, when I'm talking about the future of faith in America, when I talk about the Jewish-Christian encounter, I quote, among quotes from philosophers, from Rabbi Soloveitchik, I quote this tiny book, little known, that Maria Johnson from University of Scranton about her neighbors, wrote about her neighbors. I quote that because I think it's one of the best books about interfaith relationships that has ever been written. But now, as I speak to you tonight, I have found deeper relevance in the book. Because the more I thought about it, the more I realized that this is a book for our time, much more so than when I read it over a decade ago. Because rightly understood, Maria Johnson's Strangers and Neighbors is not only an interesting, amusing, and moving volume. It is vital reading for us today, because we need reminding, in a time when Jew hate is to be found in so many aspects of existence, that there are those that genuinely love the Jewish people. Indeed, I think Johnson's small, beautiful book is the ultimate embodiment of philo-Semitism, of love of the Jewish people. A book that allows us to understand theologically the nature of philo-Semitism itself. And this is what I would like to explain in the rest of my remarks. Philo-Semitism, I think, is rooted in a response to the mystery of Jewish eternity, in coming face to face with the fact of what was best perhaps expressed by Tolstoy, who said, "The Jew is the emblem of eternity, he whom neither slaughter nor torture of thousands of years could destroy, he whom neither fire nor sword nor inquisition was able to wipe off the face of the earth, he who was the first to produce the oracles of God, he who has been for so long the guardian of prophecy and who transmitted it to the rest of the world. Such a nation cannot be destroyed. The Jew is as everlasting as is eternity itself." This is Tolstoy's description. And it's with this aspect of Jewish existence that Johnson's own fascination with Judaism can be better understood. Because along with her Western Wall experience, she recounts one other realization that drew her to her Jewish neighbors. She tells us that she was asked by the University of Scranton to teach an introductory course to what she called the Old Testament. And this is not her field. Her field is systematic theology. So she chose to approach it as she would a work of literature. She had her students approach scripture, Hebrew scripture, the way they would a Victorian novel, a self-contained story, not thinking about the Bible's continuing relevance today. But then she tells us, as she's walking outside of her home on the way to class, on the way to teach this book, on the way to teach the story of the Jewish people, she sees Jews calling each other by the same names that she is encountering in this text from thousands of years ago. She writes that she was overwhelmed by the fact that she was, quote, living down the road from descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, from blood relatives of Moses, Aaron, and David, of Hosea, Hezekiah, and Nehemiah. And then she goes on to talk about it even more from a Christian perspective. And then she adds that she realizes that this is not just a work of literature, because its story is ongoing. Where she put it, the story very obviously was alive and well. You don't run into the descendants of Oliver Twist or find yourself living down the road from people who trace their ancestry back to Anna Karenina or Huck Finn. So, in other words, she's confronting the question of how can it be that a story that began many thousands of years ago continues through the same faith and the same family today? This is a question that any study of the Hebrew Bible immediately inspires. How are the Jews still enduring, still flourishing, when so many other nations have disappeared, when much mightier peoples have once stood over the world like a colossus and then ceased to exist? This is the ultimate question. And it is a question, actually, that deep down both the anti-Semite and the philo-Semite ask. It's a question to which the anti-Semite responds with hatred and anger and jealousy. And it's a question to which the philo-Semite responds with wonder and awe. And Maria Johnson is certainly grouped in the latter set. In describing why it is such a profound joy for her to witness the celebrations of Jewish holidays by Jews, why it's so inspiring to ponder Passover or Purim and to stand by as Hanukkah candles are lit, she writes in her book, reflecting about the very birth of the biblical people of Israel. She writes, "It defies all conceivable logic that a tiny nation like Israel should have survived, while civilizations and empires have arisen, triumphed, and crumbled into oblivion. But in defiance of logic, here they are, a blessing to the nations and a blessing to me. And when they invite me to celebrate their crazy victories over history, I'm there with all my heart." So she writes. And this is the beginning of philo-Semitism. It's a drawing of faith from the miracle that is Jewish existence. But interestingly, ladies and gentlemen, the Torah predicts another aspect of Gentile admiration of Jews, and it relates to the mitzvot, to the many and manifold laws of the Torah. Deuteronomy describes that when the world witnesses the observance of the Torah, there will be those that respond to our embrace of halakha, Jewish law, Jewish ritual, Jewish life, with admiration. Moshe says, "Behold, I have taught you statutes and ordinances as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do them in the land which you are entering to take possession of it. Keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.'" You will find such a reaction in this book. Johnson writes about how she finds the observance of halakha, Jewish law, to be extremely interesting. And she had read about it in the past, but suddenly now in her friendship, she's exposed to it in all its minutiae. She learns about the scouring and scrubbing for Passover, the complex keeping of the Shabbat, the realm of rigid rules that is the kosher kitchen. And she admits that at times it seems kind of obsessive. As she puts it, quote, "Sometimes it looks plain nuts. If my friend Chana is making chicken soup and she's running late and the noodles are boiling over and the toddler is screaming and she accidentally grabs a milk spoon and stirs, she has to stop everything and call her by Goldfarb." So she responds that deep down, at a certain point, she thinks, how important can this be? That she thinks, she writes, "Oh, come on, it's a spoon. You can't be serious." But then she adds the following, describing spoons and being asked to help at times with light switches on Shabbat. She writes, "It is clear to me that their strange vigilance about light switches and spoons and the like has brought many of my friends to a faith in, a surrender to, and a relationship with God that is at least as vital, full, and intimate as anything I can claim to have experienced myself. But," she continues, "how it works remains a mystery to me and probably always will. When I try to ask about the connection between observance and spirituality, the conversation invariably founders, probably because to them the answer to my question is so self-evident, something they take so entirely for granted, that it is hard to put into words," end quote. And this is fascinating because Rabbi Soloveitchik himself makes the case in his article about what it means to be stranger and neighbor, that there are aspects of a faith experience that can only truly, fully be experienced from within and are therefore not fully explainable or describable. But then in trying to understand Jewish law and how it works in a Jewish life, Johnson hazards a guess about how it works. And in so doing, she cites the first psalm. She continues, quote, "On the one hand, of course, the law works because it is from God. He commanded his people to obey the mitzvahs and promised to reward those who did. Then she adds the following. Psalm 1 speaks of the man who keeps aloof from the ways of the wicked and buries himself day and night in the Torah. He will be like a tree by a stream, its roots deep in good soil, growing and flourishing and bringing forth fruit. A human life rooted in Torah will bear fruit the way a tree does, not grudgingly because it has to, nor pridefully to win admiration, but simply because it is its deepest nature to do so." This is wonderful, what Johnson writes. And to further the metaphor of the tree, the laws of the Torah allow us to be spiritually rooted in the physical world, joining physicality and sanctity. As I've explained in Bible 365 when we discussed this psalm, Judaism has divinely dictated laws that relate to every aspect of human existence. How we treat the elderly, but also what foods we eat, how and whom we marry, how we conduct business righteously, how we farm, how we build a house, how we live every aspect of our lives, because we believe that the application of Jewish law to the world is what sanctifies the world. And this is the true meaning of the words that you hear all the time, misused, tikkun olam. This phrase is terribly misapplied and has all too often become synonymous with secular values rather than anything rooted in the Torah. But the actual words come from the Aleinu prayer describing the Jewish aspiration, l'takein olam b'malchut shakai, to fix the world through the kingdom of God, meaning to sanctify it. And that's why we have seemingly didactic laws that apply to every aspect of existence. I've mentioned in the past the column that David Brooks wrote in the New York Times when I gave him a tour of one of the happiest places on earth, Pomegranate Supermarket in Brooklyn, which features some of the greatest kosher products And as David wrote in the Times, what struck him is about how it seemed like a Whole Foods, except that every single product was linked to Jewish law. Or as he put it, quote, "There are the dairy-free cheese puffs in case you want to have some cheese puffs with a meat dish." Side note, ladies and gentlemen, I pointed that out to him because I think that Parv non-dairy cheese curls is one of the greatest scientific achievements of our time. And then he goes on. "There are the pre-cut disposable tablecloths so you don't have to use scissors on the Sabbath. There are the specially designed sponges which don't retain water so you don't have to do the work of squeezing out water on Shabbat. For the people who shop at Pomegranate," David Brooks wrote, "the collective covenant with God is the primary reality and obedience to the laws is the primary obligation. They go shopping like the rest of us, but their shopping is minutely governed by an external moral order." So he writes. And Johnson herself gives a similar example of how the law for Jews can sanctify every aspect of existence when she makes reference to learning about shatnez, the mysterious law in Leviticus banning in garments the mixture of wool and linen. Now, of course, my favorite shatnez story involves the Orthodox Jewish noble laureate Robert Aumann, who knew that he and his family had to wear tuxedos and tails when they went to Sweden to receive the Nobel Prize, and they found out that the ones in Sweden had shatnez in them, so they had to get special shatnez-free tuxedos. I've quoted an article in the past about this in Israel, which makes sense because obviously, if you want formal wear, Israel is the place to get it without any questions. And maybe we can link to that excellent article about the shatnez, which I'm quoting and citing from. About that story. But here's what she writes. She writes about her learning constantly about Jewish law. "At parties, when not actively making a fool of myself, I am interrupting. All conversations, whatever the topic, switch back and forth between English and Hebrew and Yiddish. There is no aspect of life," this is what she writes, "there is no aspect of life, absolutely none, that is not touched by Torah and sprinkled with foreign words. I have become quite shameless about butting in. Hey, hang on, so 10 seconds ago we were talking about the sale at Penny's. And now we're talking Hebrew. What is going on, and what is Jewish about pennies?" I think this is JCPenney's. "Endel Grinnen explained that there is a mitzvah about the kinds of fiber that can and can't be mixed in the same garment, and that if you buy something made of wool, before you can wear it, you have to send it for testing to make sure there is no linen anywhere in it. That," she writes, "is what is Jewish about pennies." So what Johnson learns is how the Torah attaches to life. Just as the article about Robert Aumann describes how you can't get a Nobel Prize without Jewish law applying. You can't shop at Penny's without Jewish law applying. And so if Johnson, looking to the Psalms, compared to the Torah, a life of the Torah, to a tree rooted in God, Rabbi Soloveitchik used a similar metaphor in describing how the Torah allows us to sanctify all of creation when he calls Jewish law the ivy that attaches itself to all of earthly existence. At times, Johnson herself sees quite clearly, despite her confusion, how the laws of the Torah ensure the sanctification of reality. And that can be most fully found in what I believe is the best chapter in the book, which is about the Sabbath. Because, of course, the Jewish Sabbath presents us with Judaism at its most didactic. It's a collection of forbidden forms of work and creation. And Johnson had assumed that it was, for her friends, just a bunch of rigid rules and annoying instructions. She tells us that, quote, "Unless someone needs me to unscrew the bulb in the refrigerator that they forgot about, we rarely see our neighbors on Shabbos. The kids who are in and out of our house all week are not allowed to come because they must be in a Shabbos house. And although our kids are welcome at their houses, I don't generally let them go, as I can't imagine that they wouldn't be in the way. My friends," she continues, "always told me that they love Shabbos, but quite frankly, I never believed them. Until recently, I assumed that Shabbos observance was a big nuisance, some sort of penitential thing that Jews had to make the best of and pretended to like for the benefit of outsiders. When someone summoned me," she writes, "as a Shabbos goy, I would do the job, chat for a couple of minutes, and then leave, assuming that they would find it an irritation to have me hanging around, watching them navigate all the annoying rules. My attitude changed suddenly and completely when I stopped by Ahuva's for some reason one Shabbos afternoon. An appetizing smell was coming from the kitchen. Yaakov and Simcha were doing puzzles on the floor. Yosef was bent over a Hebrew book at the table. David was trying to stand on his head. Something about the scene struck me as peculiar, but it took me a minute to figure out what it was. Ahuva has 8 children, runs a catering business from home, heads fundraising for the day school, works in the mikveh every evening from her children's bedtime until her own, and sews most of the clothes for her own family and lots of other people besides. She's perpetually on the move, manhandling toddlers and shopping bags in and out of the car with her sleeves rolled up, flour on her nose, needles stuck through her shirt, and the cell phone clipped to her belt ringing every 2 minutes. In years, I don't think I'd ever seen her sit down for 3 minutes at a time, even during meals. But here she was lying on the sofa with the little ones lolling against her, listening to Dina read a sci-fi novel. She couldn't cook, she couldn't sew, she couldn't shop, she didn't have to answer the phone, she just had to be. And then she adds the following, and I think this is brilliant. It was one of those sudden shifts in perspective, like when you think you have been looking at 2 black faces on a white background, and suddenly all you can see is a white vase on a black background. I had always thought of Shabbos as a 25-hour prison of petty regulation, enlivened by a bit of religion. Suddenly I saw why my friends spoke of it with such love, why they thought of the day not as a prison but as a queen, why Ahuva insists that her children spend the day in homes where Shabbos is observed. Johnson further muses that in an age of almost infinite distraction, she understands now how the seemingly didactic aspect of Jewish law, the rigidity of these law, of these rules, actually frees families to focus on the Sabbath, on what is most important, or as she puts it, quote, all of the laws, the 39 acts that generations of rabbis have multiplied into hundreds of prohibitions on the most trivial everyday activities, are an adamantine edge to chisel holiness into the week in a way that cannot be ignored or evaded by distraction and must therefore be welcomed and embraced and celebrated. And she adds that Shabbos allows Jews to, quote, experience time as creatures whom God has made in his own image and blessed and chosen and called. I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, I have read many writings in English about the Sabbath from Jews trying to explain what the Sabbath is. I have read no better description of what the Shabbat is and its importance to contemporary times and the role that Jewish law plays in it than this chapter about the Jewish Sabbath by a Catholic professor of systematic theology in the University of Scranton. And indeed, reading about it, I was so struck by it that I, a rabbi for whom Saturday is the most busy day of the week, thought to myself, this sounds amazing. Maybe one day I will get to experience this Jewish day of rest. I must look into this religion and the day of rest that it speaks about. One day, perhaps, I too will get to rest on the 7th day of the week. Now, throughout her discussion of Jewish law, when she understands it and when she doesn't, what she does comprehend in an existential, bone-deep way is that the Jews observing this in Scranton, Pennsylvania, are countercultural. And this impresses herself upon her. One of the constant criticisms of the Jewish people in the Bible itself is that we are a stiff-necked people. But Johnson finds a virtue in this, in the love of the Torah that the Jewish people reflected throughout their exiles, throughout their persecutions, throughout their history. She writes, quote, against all logic and reason, and in defiance of all the horrors of history, Jews have survived and remembered who they are, where they came from, and to whom they owe their allegiance. They have remembered and obeyed, not just when things went well, when they had cisterns and vineyards and olive groves, but also when they had nothing, when the temple was destroyed again, when they were driven into exile, when their villages were burnt by laughing Cossacks, when they were locked in ghettos and starved, when they were hoarded into cattle trucks and gas chambers. All this, she writes, the persecution and violence and hatred and suffering would have ended if only they had been willing to stop being so stubbornly different and just blend in. But their necks, she writes, are very, very stiff. And once they turned to God, they did not turn away again. So she writes, and then she adds, that the Jews are, in their countercultural ways, a, quote, constant reminder to me that the ways of the holy God are not like our ways. And so we return to Johnson's book at this time. At a time when we see anti-Semitism, we see this wondrous example of philo-Semitism. And we realize that while Johnson may have a deeper experience of traditional Judaism than most Gentile Americans. She is not alone in America in her positive attitude toward and her embrace of the Jewish people. One of my favorite stories is told by Jane Levy in her biography of Sandy Koufax, where Levy describes the Yom Kippur that Koufax famously refused to pitch, with Don Drysdale pitching instead. And he got destroyed. And so the score, I think, is 8-1. And Walter Alston, the manager, comes to take Don Drysdale off the mound. And Don Drysdale looks at the manager and says, "Hey, Skip, bet you wish I was Jewish today, too." Now, Drysdale was joking, but the truth is that we do live in an age when Jewish identity and observance is a source of admiration and is an object of admiration and a source of inspiration for non-Jews. And we need to remember this at this time, lest we give in to despair. It is so easy to focus only on the hate. And while we do need to focus on that and to fight it, we can't focus only on it. Were you to tell an ancestor of ours that in today's day and age, there is still Jew hatred that festers, that there are still excuses made for violence against Jews, excuses made for pogroms, these ancestors from hundreds of years ago or 1,000 years ago would not be surprised. They would say, "Of course." But they would be very surprised if you told them that in today's day and age, there are so many non-Jews that love the Jewish people, that care about the state of Israel, that draw inspiration for their own biblically inspired faith by the miracle that is Jewish endurance. If you told that to ancestors from hundreds of years ago or 1,000 years ago, they would be very surprised. And they might not have believed that there were non-Jews who wrote books about the Jewish faith, about Jewish observance, about Jewish law, and the lessons that could be learned from that. And when you told them that this was so, that books like Strangers and Neighbors exist, they would say, "This must be a wondrous age." I remember when I attended one of the White House Hanukkah parties during the presidency of George W. Bush, and the president was told that I was a rabbi in New York. So he put his arm around me and he says, "Rabbi, thanks for all your good work for the Lord." And at that point, I remembered a comment made by my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was a rabbi in the premier yeshiva of the Lithuanian Torah world, Volozhin. And he commented in the passage in the Torah where Jacob and Esau are reconciled, and Esau embraces Jacob with genuine love, and Jacob himself breaks down and weeps and embraces his brother. And Nitziv, writing in a time when he was surely surrounded by anti-Semitism, writing in Eastern Europe, in a town that is now found, in the middle of Belarus, he wrote in the 19th century that this embrace portends a time when, as he put it, Esau, which was taken by the rabbis to be the embodiment of the non-Jewish world, will be inspired by aspects of the Jewish faith and will embrace us. And then he writes, "We shall return that embrace, for he is our brother." So Nitziv writes at a time, in a place, where such a prediction might have seemed very strange. So President Bush was just being nice when he met me. He didn't know me from Adam, and for all he knows, I do terrible work for the Lord. But the age of which Nitziv wrote is our age. It's one embodied in the way in which President Milei or Dr. Maria Johnson reacted to the Western Wall, and in the way in which Maria Johnson concludes her introduction to Strangers and Neighbors, in a passage which speaks to her own unique attitude, but also which embodies an attitude that many Americans inherently feel. She writes, "It has been 6 years since I watched in puzzled awe as the Sabbath Queen was welcomed into the plaza by the Western Wall, and since then I have stood with a baby on my hip while she was welcomed into the living room of our neighbors 4 doors down. I have been to a bris, to a bar mitzvah, and to parties for Hanukkah and Sukkot. Of course, I'm well over my initial silly awe and shyness, but the sense of mystery and significance that held me spellbound at the wall has not been eroded by ease and familiarity. When I watch the Shabbos candles being lit or stand on the women's side of the shul while men in striped prayer shawls cluster around the wailing infant, I feel sure that what is going on is of profound importance, and not just subjectively to the people around me, but objectively to me and to the world. I am," she writes, "and will remain a Christian. but I am a rather different Christian now than I was before." End quote. In the moment in which we find ourselves, ladies and gentlemen, it is easy to despair. After all, evidence of a resurgent anti-Semitism can be found in many, many places where we look. But when Solomon first prayed that the Judaism embodied by Jerusalem could inspire, that Judaism itself could inspire people from around the world, he was describing, predicting, in part, our own age. Solomon's prediction and prayer is fulfilled through men like Millay, through women like Maria Johnson, and through countless others. And it is therefore in this trying time that we can read Strangers and Neighbors, a book written from a very Christian perspective about the Jews, and be reminded in the midst of our trying time to see ourselves from the perspective of an outsider and to realize the amazing aspects of the age in which we live. Thank you very much.